I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today's program comes from the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation between authors Juno Diaz and Jacqueline Woodson, recorded as part of a series of author conversations sponsored by 20 Summers. Diaz's work has been honored with a Pulitzer Prize and a MacArthur Award, while Woodson's books for teenage readers about growing up Black and gay have won prizes including a National Book Award and a Coretta Scott King Award.
Welcome. Juno and I thought we'd start by reading from our work for about 10 minutes, Juno? Is that what we said?
Yeah.
Okay, you want to start or you want me to start?
Please, it's dealer's choice, as they say, whichever you would like.
I'm going to read from Another Brooklyn, which is a novel. That year, every song was telling some part of our story. We crowded around the small radio in Sylvia's room and listened. When Gigi's mother wasn't home, we went there after school, waited while Gigi used the key that hung from around her neck to unlock the door. There was no couch in the one-room kitchenette, so we sat on the floor around her clothes-and-play record player, the volume turned down low. We leaned in to listen as Al Green begged us to lay our heads upon his pillow, and Tavares asked us to please remember what they told us to forget. And Minnie Riperton and Sylvia hit notes so high and so long, it felt like the world was ending. The world was ending. We had been girls wobbling around the apartment in Gigi's mother's white go-go boots, and then. Little pieces of Brooklyn began to fall away, revealing us. We envied each other's hair, eyes, butts, and noses. We traded clothes and shared sandwiches. Some days we laughed until soda sprayed from our noses and hiccups erupted in our chests. When boys called our names, we said, "Don't even say my name. Don't even put it in your mouth." When they said, "You ugly anyway," we knew they were lying. When they hollered, "Conceited," we said, "No, convinced." We watched them dip walk away, too young to know how to respond. The four of us together weren't something they understood. They understood girls alone, folding their arms across their breast, praying for invisibility. At 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, we knew we were being watched. So we warned each other about the shoe repair on Gates Avenue, how the old man who reminded us of Geppetto made you wait on a hard wooden seat in the little booth so he could steal glances at your legs and feet. Take somebody with you when you go there. Don't wear dresses. When we weren't practicing walking in Gigi's mother's shoes, we were little girls in Mary Jane's and lace-up sneakers. When the heels wore down or our soles flapped away from the tops, we were given a dollar and sent to Gates Avenue. Just a little, the man said. Please. We promised her she'd be more famous than anyone ever was. We told her no other brown girl had her strange eyes and crazily long hair. We believed ourselves when we said, "That's what Hollywood wants," and "I can't wait to see you on television," and "You'll be more famous than Diane Carroll." "Don't trust the altar boys," Gigi warned her, "if you're the only altar girl." When she opened her mouth to sing Nina Simone's Just Like Tom Thumb's Blues, our throats throbbed, our teeth locked together. Sylvia lived deep inside those notes, halfway hidden from all of us. "They got some hungry women there, man. They'll make a mess out of you." "You have to be a singer," we said. "You have to." After law. We tried to hold on. We played jump rope and we played double dutch and jacks. We chased the ice cream truck down the block, waving our change-filled fist. We frog jumped over tree stumps, pulling each other into gushing fire hydrants, learned to dance the loose booty to Sly and the Family Stone, hustled to Van McCoy. We bought t-shirts with our names and zodiac signs and iron-on letters. But still, as we slipped deeper into 12, our breasts and butts grew. Our legs got long. Something about the curve of our lips and the sway of our heads suggested more to strangers than we understood. And then we were heading toward 13, walking our neighborhood as if we owned it. "Don't even look at us," we said to the boys, our palms up in front of our faces. "Look away, look away, look away." We pretended to believe we could unlock arms and walk the streets alone, but we knew we were lying. There were men inside darkened hallways, around street corners, behind draped windows. We had long lost our razor blades, and none of us had ever truly stopped chewing on our nails. But still, "I and I and I and I," we chanted. "We and we and we and we." We hand sung Down, Down, Baby, Down by the Roller Coaster, Sweet, Sweet Baby, I'ma Never Let You Go. Because we wanted to believe we were years and years from Sweet, Sweet Babies. We wanted to believe we would always be connected this way. Sylvia, Gigi, and Angela had moved far past my longest fingernail, all the way up my arm.
This is from the final section of this book, which you need to know nothing about. And I will only read the opening fragment, and we'll take it from there. All right. It begins with year zero. All right. And the piece is called The Cheater's Guide to Love. Your girlfriend catches you cheating. Well, actually, she is your fiancé, but hey, in a bit, it so won't matter. Maybe if you had been engaged to a super open-minded Blanquita, you could have survived it. But you are not engaged to a super open-minded Blanquita. Your girl is a badass salsa densa who doesn't believe in open anything. In fact, the one thing she warned you about that she swore that she would never forgive was cheating. I will put a machete in you, she promised. And of course you swore you wouldn't do it. You swore you wouldn't do it. You swore you wouldn't do it, and you did. She'll stick around for a few months because you dated for a long, long time, because you went through much together, her father's death, your tenure madness, her bar exam, and because love, real love, it's not so easily shed. Over a tortured 6-month period, you will fly to the Dominican Republic, to Mexico, to New Zealand. You will walk the beach where they filmed The Piano, something she'd always wanted to do, and now in penitent desperation, you give it to her. She is immensely sad on that beach and walks up and down the shining sand alone, bare feet in freezing water. And when you try to hug her, she says, "Don't." She stares at the rocks jutting out of the water, the wind taking her hair straight back. On the ride to the hotel, up through those wild steeps, you pick up a pair of hitchhiker, a couple so mixed it is ridiculous. Later in the hotel, she will cry. You try every trick in the book to keep her. You write her letters. You drive her to work. You quote Neruda. You compose a mass email disowning all of your sucias. You block their emails. You change your phone number. You stop drinking. You stop smoking. You claim you're a sex addict. You start attending meetings. You blame the patriarchy. You blame your father. You blame your mother. You blame Santo Domingo. You find a therapist. You cancel Facebook. You give her all the passwords. You start taking salsa classes like you always swore you would. You claim that you were sick. You claim that you were weak. It was the book. It was the pressure. And every hour like clockwork, you say that you are so, so sorry. You try it all, but one day she will simply sit up in bed and say, "No more." Yeah. And you will have to move from the Harlem apartment that the two of you have shared. You consider not going. You consider a squat protest. In fact, you say you won't go. But in the end, you do. For a while, you haunt that city like a 2-bit ball player dreaming of a call back. You phone her every day and leave messages which she does not answer. You write her long, sensitive letters which she returns unopened. You even show up at her apartment at odd hours and at her job downtown until finally her little sister calls you, the one who was always on your side, and she makes it plain. If you try to contact my sister again, she is going to put a restraining order on you. You stop, you move back to Boston, you never see her again. That's it. Thank you. So,
we were talking about why we write, and starting by talking about that. So since I started with the reading, I think.
Of course, custom dictates. I I find this to be an interesting subject because if you're an artist, unless you're compulsive, and most artists I know are compulsive, which is its own form of protection. To be compulsive is you just do your art and you keep doing it, and you whatever the problems you encounter, you just figure a way to put your head through them. Unless you're compulsive, chances are you're asking yourself why you're doing what you're doing. Because the other branch of arts, if we can divide them so neatly, of course it's impossible, are artists who are not compulsive. Artists who actually have to talk themselves back into doing their work, and who have to talk themselves into doing their work, right? In other words, it's like, for me, my art is not compulsive. I do everything humanly possible not to write. I only write in utter extremis, which is all right. I don't think there's any problem with either side of it. You know, I think both are a form of, I would argue, productive evasions. But the one thing that not being compulsive around your work means is that you're explicitly asking yourself that question. Because you're always trying to reach a point where you could say, no, you don't really have to do it anymore. You know, for me, I'm always going down that rabbit hole and saying, is this really what you want to do? It's an interesting conversation when you have it at that level, because you begin to understand a little bit about what holds you to the page when nothing else will. And in some ways, I think about it, I think there's a simplistic braid, yeah? Like those braids my mom would do with my sister's hair. It would be very simplistic, you know? Very, very neat, but very simplistic. And it doesn't begin to cover the depths of what goes in, but sometimes when you're thinking to yourself, you use shorthand. You're just like, the name of an ex-partner defines an entire era. You just have to hear that name, and you're just like, ugh. It's place, it's time, and it's even who you were and your set of bad decisions that brought you in or out. Whatever it is, it could just a name. And so for me, I begin with these two things, which is I first begin with more or less, I absolutely love to read. It seems straightforward, it would be a given, but you'd be amazed how many writers actually don't read much anymore. You know, they're just so busy writing that they don't read. But and part of why I think I can summon myself out of whatever hole I'm in to write is this absolute infatuation with reading, and that I never read as intensely as I do when I write. That it's weird, it's like, for me, when I write, it's an opportunity to read at an Olympic level. Like, there is something burning and something is required of me, and I must read at a level with a kind of clarity and with a kind of searching intelligence, and also with it all holds. Because a lot of times I'll just read in the next book and read in the next book, but when I'm reading while I'm for a project, it all holds. Everything stays in my head. And it is more or less an excuse for me to be an even deeper reader. And it's one of the reasons I think, like, that's the one part of the simple braid, is that there is a part of me that just is always looking for an excuse to read. And then the other part, of course, is more straightforward, which is those of us of African descent know that what they call the symbolic annihilation of us in this larger culture, which is so obsessed and addicted to whiteness, means that if we stay seated even for one round, the silences multiply. That in fact, there isn't a lot of room for any of us to let go of the rope, because we could end up, you know, face down in the mud. And there's a part of me as well that looks back at the long corridors of my childhood and looks and sees what I see now, which is a culture that is so distorted by its obsession with whiteness and its obsession with straightness and its obsession with maleness, that it has warped the average childhood. That the average child spends their adult life spitting out the poisons which this larger culture interjected into them. And I know that I passed through that. I still am hawking up big bolides of cultural venom. And I would argue most of the people that I grew up with are still attempting to decolonize their lives, their beds, their every part of themselves. And for me, that's the other part that will get me up when I don't want to do this. And I say, you know, what's the plan? You know, why the hell are we doing this? And all I got to do is look back at that childhood self of mine who never had a single person, forget that looks like him, who came from these communities, ever represented in literature. And I say, once again, into the fire. Even though I'm, again, as I said, I'm not a big, big fan of the fire. And I think there is nothing wrong with that ambivalence. I think that we misrepresent for a lot of people what creativity is mm-hmm. when we assume that creativity is always this overwhelming libidinal enterprise. And I think there's nothing wrong with people being in love with their creativity. In fact, that's normal, that's great, that's necessary. But I think we have to remember to always keep the space there for people that there's other ways of being creative, and one of them is ambivalence. Some of the people who are people whose art we admire and we love were deeply ambivalent about their form. And it took me a long time to understand that too, that you could actually be a serious, committed writer from a point of ambivalence. And that most of the time we're confused. We're told if you don't absolutely love this thing, you shouldn't be in it. I don't know, that would knock out a lot of serious artists who we currently worship. And that, I think, is more or less when I think of the, if I had to give a brevis of this, a precis of this, it would be that.
It's so funny, I see my partner in the audience nodding at everything you say, having lived with me. There's so much truth in your telling. You know, I've known I wanted to be a writer since I was 7 because I just love story and loved telling stories, and I would get in trouble for lying a lot. You know, and I had a teacher who said, instead of lying, write it down, because if you write it down, it's fiction. It's and it's legit. And it was kind of this moment of like, wait, I can do this and not get in trouble for it. But from a very young age, I wanted to tell stories. I would have stories read to me, and I would say, I want to do that. I want to have other people feel what I'm feeling while someone is reading that story to me. And I also, I just loved it. But as I grew up and I wrote, and it is that point of being an adult, and it is that, you know, I will clean my house top to bottom before I sit down and write some days. And I still have a deep love for it, but I also feel like now, as I became more conscious of the power I was standing in the world, that I had a deep responsibility, too, to tell stories that I was writing because I had all of these questions. And the body of literature that answered them wasn't there yet. And I had to create that body. And I also think of Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop, who did a lot of work with African-American children's literature, and how she talked about the importance of young people having both mirrors and windows in their literature, that they could open books and see parts of themselves in the book, and that they also could open books and be introduced into worlds that they would never have imagined. And as a child, I had a lot of windows into the white world in my body of literature, and very few mirrors where people look like me existed on the page. And I wanted to create, I wanted to, you know, fill that void. And she also talked about sliding glass doors, this idea of walking into an experience through someone else's telling of it. But I do think writing is very powerful. At some point when you sit down, when I sit down and I'm like, I'm gonna create a world that I can imagine myself living in for the next 3 years, right? Because, or however long it takes me to get that story on the page. And then when that world is created and it's in the world, it's going to have an impact on the people who read it, whether it be that they have mirrors or they have windows, but also it's going to be me not being passive. I'm also a really slow reader, and I think it's for the same reason, because I'm reading stuff and rereading it and trying to get a deeper understanding of how authors get stories on the page. And in that way, it's hard to read writing that I don't love. So, you know, my partner will read a book and not be in love with it and finish it, and you get me through 5 pages and it's a wrap. You know, if it's not holding me, I'm done with it. But or if I'm not feeling like I'm learning something from reading the book, I'm done with it. But it is also, as you say, it's so interesting because I really feel like until now I haven't thought about that ambivalence that one has with their relationship to writing, especially around fans. You know, when someone comes up and they're very effusive about it, I'm like, wow, but I'm just kind of doing what I have to do because I'm compulsive and because I'm ambivalent and because I feel like I need to change the world and because I feel like I can be powerful and because the house is clean and I don't have any way to procrastinate, so.
You're listening to The Point, where today we bring you a conversation with authors Juno Diaz and Jacqueline Woodson from the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more after a short break. You're listening to The Point. Today, we're at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation between authors Jacqueline Woodson and Juno Diaz.
I'm always struck by this as artists, especially artists who, at least I don't come from an enormous amount of cultural capital or social capital around arts. I did not have anyone around me who was an artist. You know, I was talking to a friend of mine earlier about this, is how profoundly riven by inequalities even arts created by people of color are. How many of the people of color artists, the people who are published, when you scratch at their backgrounds a little bit, you soon find that they were in some sort of program or they had been selected out or they had been in a private school or they had gotten early instruction. And how rare it is to get, especially in a literary world, artists who have none of that pedigree, who are from the zero, as we say. And that's always been a part of what goes on when we think about these things, because if you don't got any models whatsoever, in some ways there's stuff that you've got to learn by yourself, right? But there's also an enormous set of possibilities because no one corrects some of your early bad habits. And some of those early bad habits are pretty, pretty generative, man. I always think that I was very lucky that I had never been in a workshop before I was 20 years old, and that I had never met a writer before I was 20. And so that I had so many wild delusions, because I think if I had known writers by the time I was 16, those wild delusions would not have developed. Well, but I think it's important. I think it's important for you to have a sense of the world before someone corrects it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one of the weird things about childhood these days is that it's hard to get a sense of the world before anyone corrects it, because childhood has become strictly instrumental and a mistake will keep you away from whatever school you're going. So I think about my childhood, I know that not having other authors or artists around, you know, could have been bad, but there's a part of me as well that thinks like, not bad, because I really did have some weird ideas about an author, and it's actually great that I had them, because they don't hurt. It doesn't hurt.
It's funny, I remember the first author I met, I was 17, and it was Betty Thomas, who had written Down
Whoa.
These Mean Streets.
You met Perry Thomas? What an opening.
I know, we were doing Down These Mean Streets. I guess our teacher brought the book to school because she knew him, and he agreed to come to our school. And this is, you know, this is Bushwick High School, 11th grade. And Bushwick, this is the old Bushwick that was an underserved community, not the hipster Bushwick that people probably know of now. And he came to our school and talked to us. And all I knew was here was a guy with a book, you know, a real quote unquote writer with a book. And I remember we were taking photos, and a bunch of us had, the college-bound students had to stand behind him, and I had my hand on his shoulder. I'm like, I'm touching an author. So, well, I don't know what happened to him.
No, Peary hung tough. He went out to the Bay Area. You know, he wrote a number of memoirs, none as successful or as well-known as Down These Mean Streets. He actually wrote a kid's book of short stories, a young adult book of short stories. Yeah, I think when you spend that much time locked up, that's a lifetime and a half. So I feel like he was really...
He was fabulous.
Yeah.
I mean, he fit right in with all of us in this way that was amazing. But also, and then also that book wasn't... It was a book that was breaking all kinds of rules, even in terms of the narrative it was putting on the page during that time. So, much needed in Bushwick.
Gone with Me Streets was a formative book for me as well.
Yeah.
Very formative. And you know, we're sitting here, think about this. We're like at the end of the, you know this, I don't need to cape-splain to y'all, but we're here at the end of Massachusetts. You know, we're at the end of Massachusetts, and yet we're up here talking about home.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think this is something worth, you know, exploring for us, because it's not an accident, right, that we're displaced and we're talking about home. But when I am home, I'm also talking about home. And that is something that has long bedeviled the writer, has long bedeviled the artist. What in the world do we mean with this idea of home? And for the artist, I think all of you know that standard stereotype, right? That trope that the artist must leave home to gain some perspective, or must leave home, must have some space between home. And there's plenty of artists, of course, who've put that trope to bed by proving the exact opposite, artists who stay at home and work. But for both of us, I think home is something that's that we've not only have made part of our art, but that I think that we've made part of our intellectual lives, thinking strictly about this. How does it begin for you? How does the idea of take the one half of the dyad, leaving home, does this have any resonance, Jacqueline, at all for you?
I feel like it resonates in every way, right? Because from the moment we become conscious, especially I think as people of color, we are already stepping outside of home, right? For us, home is this place that from media and books and TV and all of it is saying, you know, this other place is home, not where you live, because your place doesn't really exist because you haven't seen it except in the small community that you're living in. So then you go out and you're like, well, where's that other community? Because suddenly you realize you're a quote unquote other, right? Because there must be some mainstream world that you are not a part of, that you must move into. And so it becomes the whole thing of having two languages, right? That I'm blanking on what I want to say, code switching, right? So you have the world that you've always known, then you step into the world, say, of education, and you're having that dialogue, and then you go to yet another world. But yeah, you do carry home with you. For me, it was first about getting away from home to find that other world, and then understanding that home is my world, and that my work was to legitimize home first for myself and then for the bigger world. Does that make
sure.
sense?
But was college part of your drive to get the hell out of your space, or were you like, I need to stay in the city?
You know, I went to college on Long Island, so I didn't go that far from home, but it was a world away.
Which college?
Adelphi.
Oh, you went to Adelphi.
Yeah. So it was a very different space. But I feel like my earliest memory of leaving home was Bushwick and Ridgewood, New York, are separated by tracks, basically, right? The train. And walking into Ridgewood, the Ridgewood section, and seeing how different it was than the Bushwick section. Bushwick was, you know, Black and Latino, and then you go to Ridgewood and it's all white. And it's like, wait, but this is only a 4-block difference, and the schools are better, you know, the houses are solid, and all of, you know, there are shops there and restaurants. And now we're walking back 4 blocks back, and we're back home, and it's different. And I never wanted to live in Ridgewood, you know, it was corny. But I did notice that it was very different physically than the neighborhood I lived in. But then once I got to Adelphi, yeah, it was very different than Bushwick.
I had spent my first 6 years as a kid fantasizing about the United States. My father was there, thinking, oh, I'm going to go to this place and it's going to be wonderful. I'm going to be reunited with my father. And then it was nuts. Being poor in the United States, being poor of African descent, Latino, immigrant, oh, it was bananas. We were not living in New York. We were living in burnt out parts of Central Jersey. There was nothing there, and you wanted to get the hell out. You were just like, yo, so many of my friends joined the military. That was the absolute way out. You know, everybody got on there 4 years and beat it. It wasn't until I got to college that I ever gave home a second thought other than like, yo, this place was nuts. But I went to college and I was like, this is really screwed up. And I would have to cut half my heart out for me to belong here.
Mm-hmm.
Because it invites you to sell yourself to belong a place like university, especially for people from poor backgrounds, people of color. I was like, yo, I could fit in here
if I wanted to be like slightly coonish. And I could completely mess myself up and be here. And I, where I had never thought of home as being immensely valuable, suddenly college made me value my home. I was like, wow, these people lie all the time. They cannot be trusted. No, and I don't mean this as a knock, but you must know that if you come out of a community where your word is so valuable and people will never forget that you're not reliable, suddenly come into a place like a university where people's entire deception is just part of the game. It was a shocker for me. I never thought I would want to go back right away, but I was like, whoa, here we go. And I know for a fact the shock and disappointment of university began my career as an artist. Hmm. There's stuff that I'm not ashamed of, and I'm not going to apologize about my community, and I'm critical of my community, but it took me to get to middle class to realize that the whole thing was a ruse. Mm-hmm. You know, that this whole thing is a ruse, and that, you know, to be a person of color in predominantly white spaces, you're being asked to make sacrifices that not all of us want to make. And one of the sacrifices that I was being asked to make was to absolutely sever all ties with my community and to feel ashamed of my community. To be like, I am ashamed of poor people. Mm-hmm. To be like, I am ashamed of people who've never read a book. I am ashamed of people who speak 3 words of English.
Well, I'm not even questioning the people who speak 3 words of Spanish, right? It's that idea of not even having a sense that the wrongness is on that side of things.
Well, yeah. And I just ask myself, if my community has no value, why you want to separate me from it? Mm-hmm. You know, so it began there, you know. And I'm as a writer, for anyone who's ever read me, I'm a writer who has a very hard eye on my community. I don't have a sentimental, you know, oh, we're the most wonderful people on the earth. I'm nice and tough because one should be nice and tough, but that doesn't mean that
we don't love them.
Yeah, I wasn't going down that.
Yeah.
But they offered it.
yeah. And it's so interesting until you said it. It was a choice you could have made to completely disown your community and cross over. I'm constantly talking about the history of, you know, community. And when I was growing up, we were first called what? Ghetto, then underprivileged, and now it's urban, right? Because people don't want to say people of color in a poor environment. So it's like, let's just call it urban. But we know what we're talking about. So why not just say the word? And that all of that kind of unspoken language about what is going on. And those were words used to make us feel shame about where we were coming from. And meanwhile, at the same time, you know, I had so much love for the people I came from and for Bushwick. And even now what we were talking about earlier, watching that neighborhood change and become this other thing, and this way that people want to forget the history of the people who were there before. For me, writing Another Brooklyn, so much of that was about saying, you know what, we were here before this, before girls decided to start filming in Bushwick and naming it, or before artists got kicked out of Williamsburg. And then, you know, even going back, like, I think it's so important that we understand the ground we walk on. I mean, you know, New York and the Lenape, right? Like, we were not the first ones there, but watching a neighborhood that I had grown up in change and be renamed. I remember listening to NPR, and they were interviewing a woman who was making tequila, and he was like, it's kind of the Bushwick of tequilas, right? Because it's like some small batch tequila that's really good and up and coming or something. But I'm like, oh, hell no. Like, you know, let's speak the truth to the people. And I think going back to why we write and trying to make visible and keep alive the histories of the people and the communities that mean so much to us is really important. And again, comes back to having a sense of, it feels powerful to me. It feels powerful to have the tools to put this on the page and know that I've done my work. But of course, then there's so much work left to do.
Well, then we have the, if we follow up with that, if we think about leaving home, what did homecoming mean? The other part of the kind of artistic dyad, that journey, right? You leave home, you come back home. Some people don't at all. Does that resonate at all?
Yeah, see, it's interesting because I feel like I left home and I didn't leave home. I have so many close friends who are still my friends from my childhood. So the part of the narrative I left out, we both immigrated at the same time or migrated, right? So my family was part of the Great Migration. So we came from South Carolina to New York City when I was 6 or 7 years old. So from that very rural life to plop down in New York City and all that comes with migrating and leaving a place of persecution, right? And the PTSD of Jim Crow and all the things that we brought with us to New York City. So the first home I left was South Carolina and then New York City, then Bushwick for college. But I did hold on to my people, you know. I was college girl, right? When I came back to a lot in the neighborhood, but a lot of us from that particular time ended up going off to college. And then a lot of us ended up going to the military too, and a lot of us ended up going to jail, you know, and a lot of us ended up dying. So, but it was that the people that were in my life, a lot of them are still very much in my life, which just feels like a gift in this way. But also, you know, you think you kind of blend. I remember walking to my brother was living in a different part of Brooklyn, and I remember walking through the neighborhood and people going, college girl. And I'm like, what part of me says college girl? You know, is it like, were my clothes wrong? Was it that I had locks at the time? But it was interesting because I thought, you know, you still think you kind of blend into the neighborhood in this way, but I really didn't.
No, I mean, most certainly not. This for me is always intriguing because I do think, and you described it perfectly, is I belong to a community that is always checking to see where you're at after any kind of absence. Mm-hmm. I never belonged to a community where people would be like, oh, welcome back with open arms. Like, oh, you've been gone for 3 years. Ah, nah. I was always clear on that because I saw it so vividly my whole life. I think many of us claim communities that those could be very communities would never claim us, even though we're proud to claim them because we've been out of touch with them for so long. And I discovered I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be like repping this neighborhood, but yet if I walked down, people would like slam the door. You know, I didn't want that. And it was good because to be humbled as an artist for me has been an extraordinary fount of education. I have learned more by being shown my limitations than I have ever learned by being told that I was right as an artist.
You're listening to a conversation with authors Juno Diaz and Jacqueline Woodson, recorded recently at the Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. We'll have more of their discussion right after a break. You're listening to The Point. Today we are at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown for a conversation with authors Jacqueline Woodson and Juno Diaz.
I think part of my ability to write across so many lines is that sense of feeling outside everywhere, every single where, and constantly questioning that, but also embracing it. You know, I don't know if part of that comes from growing up Jehovah's Witness and, you know, having this sense of being in the world but not of the world, and just thinking that I was other in every single world that I walked into. But even in the world of writing, I mean, I think I see the blink, like you win awards or you get published, and then there are always the white folks who are like, oh, this must have happened because you're fill in the blank. And that constant questioning of it and that sense of, you know, you're working so much harder than so many people, and that could be someone's narrative. But it is, for me, this kind of stepping outside and watching the world that allows me to both tell the story and to kind of come to understand something deeper about everything. but I do feel like I spend a lot of time outside.
Yeah, no, it's funny because, you know, we all have our privileges and we all have our the privilege we don't have. I think I had the weird privilege of, I came from a big family who was very problematic, nothing that I felt even remotely proud of or remotely, you know, not untroubled by. But the one advantage of a family like the one mine was, especially to be a boy, which was not, I think, what would have been afforded to my sisters in this sort of family,
was I was offered very clearly a broad road of male privilege to proceed down. Mm-hmm. That everything that, no matter what everything else was going on, that there was this one thing that they were like, you could take a stroll down this lane, and this lane will always be a good source of like identity, of, you know, strength, that you could draw kind of all sorts of psychic benefits from it and material benefits from it. And that was, that to me was a trip, both because of how unaware I was until, of course, I, you know, you discover as an adult or as a young adult, you discovered that you happily walking down this path of masculine privilege has alienated you from your sisters. And that the same sisters that you grew up in the same two bedroom house, five of you, have never forgotten how you availed yourself of privilege and let them be disenfranchised without a second thought. And that as an artist too fed some insight on what it means to be inside, because we're all inside something. Mm-hmm. And the understanding that you can't be inside something and not in this society without disenfranchising somebody else mm-hmm. was importantly powerful for me. And I always think about the writer I am, why I'm always writing. It always looks like I'm, when I look at my work, if I abstract it, I always think like, yeah, I'm still writing to my sisters, you know, in the way like, I wish I could say I was writing to say sorry, but it's not even that. For me, it dovetails perfectly. This idea of writing in a time of alternate facts dovetails perfectly with the statement I made about how we've gutted arts education. Mm-hmm. We've gutted public education. And it's not just rancid partisanship and the kind of white supremacist fundamentalisms of this nation, where now everybody is convinced that their personal opinion is reality. That's the definition of fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is when you think your take on the world is reality. You know, I don't think this stuff is occurring simply by accident. This is what happens when you gut public education for 30 plus years. There is no critical consensus, because the average American is much more likely to have been educated in an emotional, affective response than they have to a kind of critical response. And it's going to take us a long time to rebuild that. Being literary artists, it's a very strange thing, because we're already minorities. We're like, we want people to read, you know? One, and two, we basically are the outcome of an investment in an education system. And our compass has shrank in some ways because we keep de-investing in education system. People are reading less in certain ways, in certain kinds of reading, and they're believing deceptive, bloviating hate mongers, because they have been weakened and they're susceptible to this. And as an artist, it's become a very strange situation, because what you realize is for your magic to work at a larger scale, and I'm not talking about larger scale because we want to sell more books, but to be able to just to kind of just get the basic spread, you cannot, this fish cannot swim without the water of public education. And we have drained the pond. And I'm like in a corner just wondering what the hell's happened here. And it makes us equally valuable. We're still incredibly important, but we've got to get back to refunding public education, and it's going to take a long time to do this.
Yeah, I completely agree. We come out of a history of alternative facts. I mean, we knew our communities mattered. We knew we were not invisible. We knew that there was a depth and an intelligence to the people we came from and to the history we came from. We knew how this country was built on the blood of people, on the blood of us, right? We knew that we were brought here not to survive, right? If we're going to tell the truth, as people of color, we were brought here to basically work until we died, make some more people of color who worked until they died, and then hopefully, you know, if this country had had its way, eventually died off. We were not supposed to grow into writers and Pulitzer Prize winners and presidents and teachers and lawyers and doctors. We were supposed to, as African Americans and people of the diaspora die. And that's the blood that this country was built on, and that's where the conversation begins. And so this is not new to us. This is not shocking to me. Like, I saw this coming. And that said, we have been talking about, you know, writing against that invisibility, writing against the alternative facts of what the mainstream world thinks people of color are, thinks poor people are, thinks women are, thinks queer people are, and retelling that narrative into something that is true. So yeah, we can talk about this moment right in time, this current moment, but this is not a new moment. It's a much more visible moment, and it's a moment that's impacting a lot more of us. But in terms of us as people of color, we've been fighting against this tide from the time we first came to this country. So I feel like my work is part of that continuum. And when you think of what Audre Lorde said, we need to wake up knowing we have work to do and go to bed knowing we've done it. And I feel like that's my obligation, to do my work to make this place better for people who look like me and all people. And I think that, for me, I wish that was everyone's work. And writing is about bridging that line so where people are not seeing other people as the other that has nothing to do with me, but that we're all in this together. And I think that this time around, we're realizing that this is all of us, you know, sinking. This is not just those poor people over there or those poor children of color over there, but this is about all of us finally. And maybe it's what it took for us to get here and begin the real fighting.
Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a conversation with authors Juno Diaz and Jacqueline Woodson, recorded May 27th at the historic Hawthorne Barn in Provincetown. You can hear this conversation again at our website, capeandislands.org. Thanks to Brian Morris, who recorded and edited this program. I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.